8. On Sunday morning, Hamilton was awakened at the crack of dawn by a frenzied yammering that filled the house. As he crept stiffly from bed, he recalled that Bill Laws had predicted some dire event in the early hours of the Lord's day. The blaring, screeching racket came from the living room. Entering, Hamilton found that the television set had miraculously turned itself on. The screen was alive with animation. Turgid blurs drifted and pulsed. The entire picture was an angry swirl of dangerous reds and purples. From the hi-fi speaker system came deafening thunder, relentless and impassioned, a genuine hellfire and damnation roar. This, he realized, was a Sunday morning sermon. And the sermon was being delivered by Tetragrammaton himself. Turning the set down, he padded back to the bedroom to dress. In the bed, Marcia lay huddled in an unhappy heap, trying to evade the bright glare of sunlight filtering through the window. "Time to get up," he informed her. "Don't you hear the Almighty bellowing in the living room?"
"What's he saying?"
Marcia murmured crossly.
"Nothing in particular. Repent or suffer eternal damnation. The usual tribal tub-thumping."
"Don't watch me," Marcia begged. "Turn your back while I dress. Good God, I'm a monster."
In the living room, the television set had turned itself up full blast again. Nobody was going to interfere with the weekly harangue. Trying his best not to hear, Hamilton padded into the bathroom and went through the timeless routine of washing and shaving. He was back in the bedroom, getting on his clothes, when the door chimes rang.
"They're here,"
he said to Marcia. Marcia, now dressed and struggling with her hair, gave an agonized wail.
"I can't face them. Make them go away."
"Darling," he told her firmly, lacing up his shoes, "if you hope to get your old self back..."
"You all home?"
Bill Laws's voice came.
"I just push open the door and walk right in."
Hamilton hurried into the living room. There was Laws, graduate student in advanced physics, arms dangling at his sides, white eyeballs popping, knees bent, body lank and shambling. He grotesquely swiveled his way over to Hamilton.
"You all look a here," he told Hamilton. "Look, man, how I been done in. This yeah goddamn world done kicked me square in the ass."
"Are you doing this on purpose?" Hamilton demanded, not sure whether to be amused or outraged.
"Purpose?"
The Negro gazed vacantly at him.
"What you all mean, Massa Hamilton?"
"You're either completely in Sylvester's hands or you're the most cynical man I've ever met." Suddenly, Laws's eyes flickered.
"Sylvester's hands? What do you mean?"
His dialect was gone. Instantly, he was alert, tense.
"I thought it was his everlasting majesty."
"The dialect was an act, then?" Laws's eyes gleamed.
"I'm beating it, Hamilton. The pull is there. I can feel it slipping in. But I'm going it one better."
At that moment, he caught sight of Marcia.
"Who's that?"
Lamely, Hamilton explained.
"My wife, this thing has hold of her."
"Jesus,"
Laws said softly.
"What are we going to do?"
The door chimes sounded again. With a wail, Marcia disappeared back into the bedroom. This time, it was Miss Rice. Brisk and severe, she strode into the living room, dressed in a strict gray business suit, low heels, horn-rimmed glasses.
"Good morning," she said in a clipped staccato. "Mr. Laws told me there is..."
She broke off, surprised.
"That racket."
She indicated the yammer and din of the television set.
"It's on yours, too?"
"Of course, he's given everybody the works."
Noticeably, Miss Rice relaxed.
"I thought it was just me he had singled out."
Through the half-open front door came the pain-racked shape of Charlie McFife.
"Greetings," he muttered.
His now violently swollen jaw was bandaged. A white cloth was wrapped around his neck, pushed down inside his collar. Picking his way with care, he crossed the living room toward Hamilton.
"Can't you beat it?"
Hamilton asked sympathetically. McFife glumly shook his head.
Can't.
What's this all about?
Miss Rice wanted to know.
Mr. Law said you have something to tell us, something about this peculiar conspiracy going on.
Conspiracy? Hamilton eyed her uneasily. That's hardly the term for it.
I agree,
Miss Rice said fervently, misunderstanding him.
It goes far beyond any mere conspiracy.
Hamilton gave up. Going to the closed bedroom door, he knocked urgently.
Come on out, sweetheart. Time to head for the hospital.
After a tormented interval, Marcia emerged. She had put on a heavy overcoat and jeans, and in an attempt to conceal her ratty hair, she had tied it up in a red kerchief. She wore no makeup. It would have been a waste of time.
All right,
she said wanly.
I'm ready.
Hamilton parked McFife's Plymouth in the hospital lot. As the five of them trooped across the gravel toward the hospital buildings, Bill Laws said,
Sylvester is the key to all this.
Sylvester is all this, Hamilton said.
The dream you and Marcia had is the key, and various other facts, such as your shuffling and her altered appearance, the status of the second Babists, this whole geocentric universe. I get the feeling that I know Arthur Sylvester inside and out, mostly inside.
Are you positive? Laws said doubtfully.
All eight of us dropped into the proton beam of the Bevatron. During the interval, there was only one consciousness, one frame of reference for the eight of us. Sylvester never lost consciousness.
Then, Laws said practically, we're not actually here.
Physically, we're stretched out on the floor of the Bevatron, but mentally, we're here. The free energy of the beam turned Sylvester's personal world into a public universe. We're subject to the logic of a religious crank, an old man who picked up a screwball cult in Chicago in the 30s. We're in his universe, where all his ignorant and pious superstitions function. We're in the man's head.
He gestured.
This landscape, this terrain, the convolutions of a brain, the hills and valleys of Sylvester's mind.
Oh, dear,
Miss Rice whispered.
We're in his power. He's trying to destroy us.
I doubt if he's aware of what's happened. That's the irony of it. Sylvester probably sees nothing odd about this world. Why should he? It's the private fantasy world he's lived in all his life.
They entered the hospital building. Nobody was in sight. From all rooms boomed the aggressive roar of Tetragrammaton's Sunday morning sermon.
That's right, Hamilton admitted. I forgot about that. We'll have to be careful.
The information desk was untended. Probably the whole staff was off watching the sermon. Examining the mechanical directory, Hamilton found Sylvester's room number. A moment later, they were ascending in the silent hydraulic elevator. The door to Arthur Sylvester's room was wide open. Inside sat the thin, upright old man, intently facing his television set. With him were Mrs. Edith Pritchett and her son, David. Mrs. Pritchett and David fidgeted uneasily. With a sigh of weak relief, they greeted the group as it filed into the room. Sylvester, however, did not stir. Relentlessly, with fanatic sternness, he sat facing his god, absorbed in the angry swirl of bellicose, chest-beating sentiments that poured out into the room. Clearly, Arthur Sylvester was not surprised to find himself addressed by his maker. It was obviously a part of his Sunday routine. On Sunday morning, he ingested his week's supply of spiritual nourishment. David Pritchett strolled peevishly over to Hamilton.
Who the heck is that?
He demanded, pointing at the screen.
I can't get with it.
His mother, plump, middle-aged, sat daintily gnawing on a cored apple, her bland face devoid of comprehension. Except for a nebulous aversion to the dinning blare, she was indifferent to the phenomenon on the screen.
It's hard to explain, Hamilton told the boy. You probably never ran into him before.
The aged, bony skull of Arthur Sylvester turned slightly. Two harsh and uncompromising gray eyes fixed themselves on Hamilton.
No talking, he said, in a voice that chilled Hamilton.
Without another word, he turned back to the screen. This was the man whose world they had got themselves into. For the first time since the accident, Hamilton felt authentic and unmistakable fear.
"I guess," Laws muttered out of the side of his mouth, "we all am going to have to listen to this yer speechifying."
What Laws said appeared to be so. How long, once he had got the stage, did he customarily hold forth? 10 minutes later, Mrs. Pritchett had had all she could stand. With an exasperated moan, she climbed to her feet and made her way to the back of the room where the others stood.
"Good heavens!" she complained. "I never could abide those ranting evangelists. It doesn't seem to me I've heard one so noisy in all my life."
"He'll give up," Hamilton said, amused. "He's getting winded."
"Everybody in this whole hospital is watching," Mrs. Pritchett revealed, her face clouding into a displeased pout. "It's not good for David. I've tried to bring him up to see the world rationally. This isn't a good place for him."
"No," Hamilton agreed. "It certainly isn't."
"I want my son to be well-educated," she confided gushily, her ornate hat dancing and swaying. "I want him to know the great classics, to experience the beauties of life. His father was Alfred B. Pritchett. He did that wonderful rhyme translation of the Iliad. I think great art should play a part in the ordinary man's life, don't you? It can make his existence so much richer and more meaningful."
Mrs. Pritchett was almost as much a bore as Tetragrammaton. Miss Joan Rice, her back to the screen, said,
"I just don't think I can stand another minute of it. That awful old man sitting there lapping that rubbish up."
Her intense face twitched spasmodically.
"I'd like to pick up something, anything, and smash it over his head."
"Ma'am," Laws told her, "that there old man, he fix you all up like you never been fixed up, if in you all do that."
Mrs. Pritchett listened to Laws's dialect with vapid pleasure.
"Regional accents ring so sweetly on the air," she told him fatuously. "Where are you from, Mr. Laws?"
"Clinton, Ohio," Laws said, losing his accent.
He shot her a look of wrath. This was one reaction he hadn't anticipated.
"Clinton, Ohio," Mrs.
Pritchett repeated, retaining her bland delight.
"I've passed through there. Doesn't Clinton have a very lovely opera company?"
As Hamilton turned back to his wife, Mrs. Pritchett was listing her favorite operas.
"There's a woman who wouldn't notice if no world existed," he said to Marcia.
He had spoken softly, but at that moment, the roaring sermon came to an end. The muddled swirl of temper faded from the screen. In an instant, the room drooped into silence. Hamilton was chagrined to hear his last words blare out noisily in the abrupt quiet. Slowly, inexorably, Sylvester's aged head swiveled on the broomstick neck.
"I beg your pardon," he said in a quiet, frigid voice. "Did you have something to say?"
"That's right," Hamilton said. He couldn't back out now. "I want to talk to you, Sylvester. The seven of us have a bone to pick, and you're on the other end." In the corner, the television set showed a group of angels happily singing close harmony versions of popular hymns. Faces vacant and empty, the angels swayed languidly back and forth, generating a mildly jazzy touch to the lugubrious cadences. "We have a problem," Hamilton said, his eyes on the old man. Probably, Sylvester had the power to hurl the seven of them down into hell. After all, this was his world. If anybody had pull with Tetragrammaton, it was certainly Arthur Sylvester.
"What problem is that?" Sylvester asked. "Why aren't the lot of you at prayer?"
Ignoring him, Hamilton continued. "We've made a discovery about our accident. How are your injuries mending, by the way?" A smirk of calm satisfaction covered the withered face.
"My injuries," Sylvester informed him, "are gone. Faith is responsible, not these meddling doctors. Faith and prayer will carry a man through any trial."
He added,
What you refer to as an accident was the method by which Providence tested us. God's way of discovering what kind of fiber we're made out of.
Oh, dear,
Mrs. Pritchett protested, smiling confidently.
I'm sure Providence wouldn't subject people to such an ordeal.
The old man studied her relentlessly.
The one true God, he stated categorically, is a stern God. He deals out punishment and reward as he sees fit. It is our fate to submit. Mankind was put here on this earth to fulfill the will of the cosmic authority.
Of the eight of us, Hamilton said, seven were knocked unconscious by the impact of the fall. One of us remained conscious. That was you. Sylvester nodded in complacent agreement.
As I fell, he explained, I prayed to the one true God to protect me.
From what?
Miss Rice broke in.
His own ordeal?
Waving her away, Hamilton continued. There was a lot of free energy running around the Bevatron. Normally, each individual has a unique frame of reference, but because we all lost consciousness while we were in the energy beam, and you didn't. Sylvester was not listening. He was gazing intently past Hamilton, toward Bill Laws. A righteous indignation glowed in his sunken cheeks.
Is that, he said thinly, a person of color standing there?
That's our guide, Hamilton said.
Before we continue,
Sylvester said evenly,
I'll have to ask the colored person to step outside. This is the private quarters of a white man.
What Hamilton said came from a level beyond careful reasoning. He had no excuse for saying it. The words rose too naturally and spontaneously to be defended.
The hell with you,
he said, and saw Sylvester's face turn bleak as stone. Well, it had happened, so he might as well do it right. A white man? If that second bab, or whatever it's called, that tetragrammaton rubbish you've invented, can sit back and listen to you say that, he's more of a worthless, broken-down travesty of a god than you are of a man. Which is saying a lot. Mrs. Pritchett gasped. David Pritchett giggled. Stricken, Miss Rice and Marcia involuntarily backed away. Laws stood rigid, his face pained and sardonic. Off in the corner, McFife dully nursed his distended jaw and seemed barely to have heard. Gradually, Arthur Sylvester rose to his feet. He was no longer a man. He was an avenging force that transcended humanity. An agent of purification, he was defending his cultish deity, his country, the white race, and his personal honor all at once. For an interval, he stood gathering his powers. A vibration shook through his gaunt frame, and from deep inside his body came a slow, gummy, poisonous hate.
I believe, he said, that you are a nigger lover.
That's so, Hamilton agreed. And an atheist, and a red. Have you met my wife? A Russian spy. Have you met my friend Bill Laws? Graduate student in advanced physics. Good enough to sit down at the dinner table with any man alive. Good enough to... On the television screen, the chorus of Mixed Angels had ceased singing. The image wavered. Dark waves of light radiated menacingly, a growing anger, a fluid motion. The speaker no longer carried lachrymose music. Now a dull rumble rattled the tubes and condensers. The rumble grew to an ear-splitting thunder. From the television screen emerged four vast figures. They were angels, big, brutish, masculine angels, with mean looks in their eyes. Each must have weighed 200 pounds. Wings flapping, the four angels directed themselves toward Hamilton. His wrinkled face smirking, Sylvester stepped back to enjoy the spectacle of heavenly vengeance striking down the blasphemer. As the first angel descended to deliver the cosmic judgment, Hamilton knocked it cold. Behind him, Bill Laws swept up a table lamp. Leaping forward, he smashed the second angel over the head. Stunned, the angel struggled to get hold of the Negro.
Oh, dear,
Mrs. Pritchett wailed.
Somebody called the police.
It was hopeless. Off in the corner, McPhyfe awoke from his stupor and made a futile pass at one of the angels. A blast of clear energy lapped over him. Very quietly, McPhyfe collapsed against the wall and lay still. David Pritchett, yelling excitedly, grabbed up bottles of medicine from the bedside table and lobbed them haphazardly at the angels. Marcia and Miss Rice fought wildly, both of them hanging on to one hulking, dull-witted angel, dragging him down, kicking and scratching at him, pulling his feathers out in handfuls. More angels soared from the television screen. Arthur Sylvester watched with smug satisfaction as Bill Laws disappeared under a mound of vengeful wings. Only Hamilton remained, and there was little left of him. Coat torn, nose streaming blood, he was putting up a determined last-ditch fight. Another angel went down, kicked squarely in the groin. But for every one put out of commission, a whole flock sailed from the 27-inch television screen and rapidly gained full stature. Retreating, Hamilton backed toward Sylvester.
"If there was any justice in this stinky, rundown world of yours!"
he gasped. Two angels leaped on him, blinded, choking. He felt his legs slide out from under him. With a cry, Marcia struggled to make her way over. Wielding a gleaming hatpin, she stabbed one of the angels in the kidney. The angel bellowed and let go of Hamilton. Snatching up a bottle of mineral water from the table, Hamilton swung it despairingly. The bottle exploded against the wall. Shards of glass and foaming water spouted everywhere. Sputtering, Arthur Sylvester backed away. Miss Rice collided with him. Wary as a cat, she spun, gave him a violent shove, and scrambled away. Sylvester, an astonished expression on his face, stumbled and fell. A corner of the bed rose to meet his brittle skull. There was a sharp crack as the two hit. Groaning, Arthur Sylvester sagged into unconsciousness. And the angels vanished. The hubbub died. The television set became silent. Nothing remained but 8 damaged human beings, strewn in various postures of injury and offense. McPhyfe was totally unconscious and partly singed. Arthur Sylvester lay inert, eyes glazed, tongue extended, one arm twitching reflexively. Bill Laws, sitting up, groped to pull himself to his feet. Terror-stricken, Mrs. Pritchett peeped into the room from the doorway, her soft face bubbling with dismay. David Pritchett stood winded, his arm still full of the apples and oranges he had been hurling. Laughing hysterically, Miss Rice cried,
"We got him! We won! We won!"
Dazed, Hamilton gathered together the trembling form of his wife. Slim, panting, Marcia huddled against him.
"Darling," she whispered, eyes bright with tears, "it's all right, isn't it? It's over."
Against his face, her soft brown hair billowed, her skin, smooth and warm, pressed against his lips. Her body was frail, slender, the light, lithe body he remembered. And the sack-like garments were gone. In a trim little cotton blouse and skirt, Marcia hugged him in grateful, joyous relief.
"Sure,"
Laws muttered, standing upright with effort. One closed eye was swelling ominously. His clothes were in tatters.
"The old bastard is out. We knocked him cold. That did it. Now he's no better than the rest of us. Now he's unconscious, too."
"We won,"
Miss Rice was repeating, with compulsive emphasis.
"We escaped from his conspiracy."
Doctors came racing from every part of the hospital. Most of the medical attention was directed toward Arthur Sylvester. Grimacing weakly, the old man managed to clamber back into his chair before the television set.
"Oh, thank you,"
he muttered.
"I'm fine, thanks. I must have had a dizzy spell."
McPhyfe, who was starting to revive, pawed happily at his jaw and neck. His multiple curses were gone. With a glad shout, he ripped away the bandage and wadded cloth.
"Gone!"
he yelled.
"Thank God!"
"Don't thank God," Hamilton reminded him dryly. "Quit while you're ahead."
"What was going on up here?"
a doctor demanded.
"A little scuffle."
Ironically, Laws indicated the box of strewn chocolates that had spilled from the bedside table. Over who got the last buttercream? There's only one thing wrong, Hamilton murmured, deep in preoccupied thought. It's probably just a technical matter.
What's that?
Marcia asked, pressed tight against him. Your dream. Aren't we all lying in the Bevatron, more or less unconscious? Aren't we physically suspended in time?
Gosh,
Marcia said, sobered.
That's so. But we're back. We're safe.
Apparently. Hamilton could feel her heart beating, and more slowly, the rise and fall of her breathing. And that's what counts. She was warm, soft, and wonderfully slim. As long as I have you put together the way you were. His voice died away. In his arms, his wife was slim all right. Too slim. Marcia, he said quietly, something has gone wrong. Instantly, her lithe body stiffened.
Wrong? What do you mean?
Take off your clothes. Urgently, he caught hold of the zipper of her skirt. Come on, hurry! Blinking, Marcia edged away from him.
Here? But darling, with all these people—
Come on! He ordered sharply. Bewildered, Marcia began unfastening her blouse. Slipping out of it, she tossed it on the bed, and then bent to remove her skirt. Shocked and horrified, the group of people watched as she stepped from her underclothing and stood naked in the center of the room. She was as sexless as a bee.
Look at you!
Hamilton accused her savagely.
For God's sake, look! Can't you feel it?
Astonished, Marcia glanced down at herself. Her breasts were totally gone. Her body was smooth, slightly angular, without primary or secondary sex characteristics of any sort. Slim, hairless, she might have been a young boy, but she wasn't even that. She was nothing. Absolutely and unequivocally neuter.
What?
She began, frightened.
I don't understand.
We're not back, Hamilton said. This isn't our world.
But the angels,
Miss Rice said.
They disappeared.
Touching his normal-sized jaw, McFife protested.
And my abscess tooth's okay.
This isn't Sylvester's world either, Hamilton told him. It's somebody else's. Some third party's. Good Lord. We'll never get back. Agonized, he appealed to the stunned figures around him.
How many worlds are there? How many times is this going to happen?